What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined for the second time in a row this week by my all-time best friend, Rohan Nadkarni, because our other good friend, Chris Herring, is still teaching and will be back next week. Rohan, I gave you some unofficial homework after our last episode, and it was to please watch at least one episode of Netflix's smash hit television show, Squid Game. So my question to you is, how much Squid Game have you watched, and what are your thoughts about Squid Game?
You know, Mike, there's actually a lot of layers to this question, because unlike you, I actually like to take your advice. I actually like to participate in this friendship and engage in discourse. So I did watch the first episode of Squid Game. Quite enjoyed it. I do have a couple issues with some of the tropes I saw. Not issues, but just things that I'm like, do I need another like super pathetic deadbeat dad character in my life? Do I need another a seemingly psycho rich person with unlimited money? It feels very like early 2000s young adult novel to me, but that's not a criticism. That's not a bad thing. I'm going to keep watching the show. And it's funny because this dovetails into something I need to bring up, Mike, which as loyal listeners of this podcast have known, I've been pushing you to watch Love Island for months now.
You have.
You refuse to watch an episode. And I was going to get on this podcast and complain about Squid Game spoilers, but that would be hypocritical, Mike, because I, like an idiot, made a huge Love Island spoiler on our last podcast, and we got an email about it. So big apologies to our friend Ari all the way over in Australia, who's a huge Grizzlies fan, who started watching the show because of how much I've talked about it on the podcast. And
brutal.
Is trying to get you to watch it, too. I'm truly sorry. I would never want to ruin something like that for someone. All I will say is that it truly does not matter who wins or loses on Love Island. It's really all about the drama that it takes to get there. I had the ending of the season spoiled for me, and I still enjoyed it. So, Ari, please accept my sincerest apologies. I will be more careful about spoilers in the future. But, Mike, I think it shows the power of community that our show is, you know, the listeners of our show are willing to watch Love Island, but it also shows maybe the flaws in our friendship that you're not willing to give it a look. So
I will eventually. It's not like I'm dismissing you and your opinions. I have respect for both of them.
for both,
you know,
of
I
my
wanna,
opinions.
Yes. I want to have a deeper conversation about Squid Game once you start actually watching the show. Cause I feel like we could, and this kind of stinks that the show dropped when it did, cause it would have been absolutely tremendous off-season content for us to kind of power rank the games that the characters go through on the show, and see, you know, have our loyal listeners vote on who would survive until the, like me or you. I just think it would have been a lot of fun to do it.
I agree. Can I throw one last thing out there before we really dive in? Because we got a lot of good basketball stuff that we want to get to today. The season's creeping up. But there's one more thing I want to throw out there. I tweeted about this yesterday, and normally I don't like to come on this podcast and talk about my tweets. But if you're at a coffee shop, okay, You can't. This isn't the time for you to be looking at the menu. This isn't the time for you to be catching up with someone at the back of the store whose face you recognize. You go up there, you order your coffee within 30 seconds, and you walk away. Okay, someone was taking like 4 minutes in front of me at the coffee shop yesterday, and I was like, "This is absurd. What is there's literally nothing necessitates this interaction being this long."
It's not even like, you know, that Curb episode where Larry David is waiting in line at an ice cream shop because the woman in front of him has to try every flavor. Like, what could you possibly be doing with a coffee?
I got responses. People are like, I need to see the menu. And I'm like, what are they throwing out there? A flavored latte that you got to decide if you want? Listen, this is how every single one of my interaction goes. I go up there. They're like, "Hey, Rohan, nice to see you again." I'm like, "Thank you. How are you?" They're like, "Good." And I'm like, "Cold brew, please. Splash of oat milk." That's it. And then I pay. Good Lord.
This is probably the best opening 5 minutes on an NBA podcast of all time. So I just want to give
that, this is why I have to live in coastal cities.
Oh, that's wonderful. So anyway, on today's show, you and I are going to open up the mailbag once again a little bit, and we're going to tackle a fun thought exercise that we were supposed to do weeks ago. But first, a quick thank you and a quick reminder to all of our listeners to please keep your emails coming in, openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. We got a bunch of notes from the Open Floor Globe over the past few days about our anti-vax conversation, I guess is how I will label it. They were really thoughtful, and even though we aren't going to really talk about that issue today, we just wanted to quickly acknowledge everyone who wrote in. We really appreciate you. Okay, so we want to start today's show by talking about an article that was written earlier this week by The Athletic's Shams Charania, Sam Amick, and Bill Oram. It's
Shout
a deep
out
dive.
To Bill, by the way, real quick, who was in his bag at Media Day. I believe it was Bill Oram who said to Dwight Howard, after Dwight Howard said he wasn't going to get into his vaccine because that's HIPAA law, Bill Oram said that's not what HIPAA is, but okay. Shout out to Bill.
I agree. I mean, we got to clarify to these players what HIPAA is, but that's a different conversation for a different day. Anyway, this story on the Lakers just did a really great job detailing how Russell Westbrook ended up in Los Angeles, along with providing a bunch of other juicy tidbits about the NBA's, I guess I'm going to call them the NBA's most polarizing team. Would you say that's fair, Rohan?
I think that's very fair.
Okay, so you wanted to discuss this article when it dropped on Monday's show, but we had other things that we had to discuss. So we're getting to it right now. And I know that you also wrote a column the other day that everyone should go read on SI.com about how age is not the Lakers' biggest issue. It's fit, which is something we've talked about on the show ad nauseum. So I'm just going to throw it to you to start, Ro. Just what were your biggest takeaways from this story after you read it?
Just how much LeBron apparently has leaned into genuinely being the general manager of this team, that he's basically doing free agent calls from his house with Jared Dudley as his second or third in command. Just, you know, he's talking to Westbrook, he's talking to DeRozan. Listen, LeBron is a GM, a little bit of a spotty track record, okay? And it kind of feels like this team was built in his image and his vision, and it's kind of betting on him being able to make all this work. And I wrote in my story, and we've talked about the awkward fit of the Lakers. The only age that matters on the Lakers is LeBron, okay? And he's going to be 37 in December. I just don't know why they're taking such massive gambles with him this point in his career, when there's a winning formula that's pretty easily out there. But instead they're trying to do, let's bring in another ball handler, let's bring in all these old vets. Like it just feels like there's a formula out there that makes sense that they're running away from. But then again, it seems to be that's what LeBron wants. This is the team he wanted. He clearly had a lot of input in how this team was built. And I just think the idea that he's doing his own free agent calls is kind of crazy.
That is certainly a takeaway. I would agree for sure. I did like the details of his compound in Brentwood with the mahogany. What was it like? The mahogany cigar case?
Room. Yeah. Well, yeah. I think a lot of people were expecting it to make an appearance on Monday Night Football when he Skyped in with Peyton and Eli, but unfortunately did not.
I forgot that you are now just like an NFL correspondent for Sports
Exactly.
Illustrated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to me, I don't even know if this is like a takeaway, but just kind of the big theme, maybe that's also not the right word, just what I felt when I was reading the story is just like the Lakers' constant search for relevance, even when it's at the cost of being competitive, is so funny to me. Like, so long as Jeannie Buss is the owner, they will prioritize name over substance. They are willing to sacrifice continuity. They're willing to sacrifice chemistry for the sake of relevance and attention that in reality they do not need because they are the Lakers. So that was one
like
of the big...
Kyle Kuzma's going to get that hype, you know?
Exactly, or Alex Caruso. But, like, this was the one reason that they backtracked on the Kings and struck a deal for Westbrook instead of Buddy Hield because, and I'm going to quote a line from the story, while she, meaning Jeannie Buss, has long since empowered Rob Pelinka to be the final front office decision maker, the impact of her family's legacy remains strong. And the Westbrook deal, quite clearly, was seen as the kind of move that would make her late father, legendary Lakers owner Dr. Jerry Buss, smile. So I don't know how much any of that statement bothers Lakers fans, but if I were a Lakers fan, it would bother me. Like, if Dr. Jerry Buss could have seen the three-point revolution take place, maybe he starts smiling at other things. It's just like what I, you know, just throwing that out there. But that mindset just stretches elsewhere beyond the Westbrook transaction. You know, the article touches on their decision to bring in Andre Drummond. And from where I sat when that happened to after reading the article today, like, he was brought in because he was a big name. Even though, you know, there was a risk of him pissing off Marc Gasol.
The Drummond move was a disaster because they were playing really well with Gasol, and then they alienate him, even mm-hmm. though if you're going to play a center next to AD, he's the guy you want.
Right. Exactly. So you disrupt the team's chemistry in a very predictable way. You disrespect a borderline Hall of Famer in the process, and basically, like, he just was never going to come back, which was reported in that article. He was so upset. Another tidbit in there was that Frank Vogel only got a 1-year contract extension, which is obviously insulting, as the article points out.
I don't know what Frank Vogel has to do to get some respect in LA. He only won a title in year one, even though there was the bubble. They had to deal with, obviously, the death of Kobe Bryant. That year started with them being stuck in China. Last year, he has them with the number one defense in the league, even though all their players are hurt. I don't know what they're thinking with Frank Vogel. I mean, I guess he's aligned with LeBron is how it's sold in the story contract-wise, but crazy.
Well, I mean, that's just like kind of, I don't know, that's very weird because, yes. I mean, he just won the title and AD is under contract for longer. So,
true.
You know, the article mentions Mike Budenholzer's extension was for 3 years after mm-hmm. Mike Budenholzer won the championship.
After Nate McMillan, Mike Budenholzer was also fired on Twitter.
sure, exactly. Yeah. And like Nate McMillan, you know, had a wonderful season last year taking over for Lloyd Pierce. On March 1st, he signs a 4-year contract off of that. So it's just like, I thought that was in line with how the Lakers operate. And maybe like I'm a little off step or off base here. But honestly, what I believe in my heart of hearts is that from the Lakers' point of view, Frank Vogel is just not a glitzy persona. Like, he's not a sexy name. And that's just how I always think when the Lakers are making some of the decisions that they make, from bringing in Carmelo, even though Carmelo's just, I know, I understand, like, Carmelo is only on a 1-year vet min, but just like, he's just not very good. He's not going to play for you in the playoffs.
In what lineup can LeBron and Carmelo play together? Then LeBron's not playing center.
I mean, in the playoffs, I don't think they're, I just don't think he can be on the floor. Like, you know, we'll see with matchups and everything like that. But
can they play Melo, LeBron, and AD together?
I mean, offensively, that's fine. You could put me next to LeBron and AD, right. And I think you'd be okay.
Yeah, this is the real problem, though, and it's what I touched on in my story, is that defensively, this team is taking a gigantic step backward with the additions they made this summer, even though that was the backbone of their success the last 2 years. And if you really run down their list of players who they acquired, I mean, just think about the last time we saw them in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Last time we saw Russell Westbrook in the playoffs, the Lakers were literally ignoring him whenever he didn't have the ball. Kendrick Nunn was getting cooked in the Miami-Milwaukee series. Carmelo Anthony was getting cooked in the Nuggets-Blazers series. Trevor Ariza's probably the best addition they made. I mean, I think he can still shoot. I think he can still defend. But he's not a perimeter stopper, and he's going to be their premier perimeter stopper. Malik Monk wasn't even offered a qualifying offer by the Hornets. You've never even seen him in the playoffs. Even though he came into the league as a shooter, he's kind of been an inconsistent shooter mm-hmm. throughout his career so far. You just go up and down the list of the people they brought in. Wayne Ellington, last time he was in the playoffs, another guy who gets targeted on every possession.
So let's.
They added a ton of one-way guys, and it's just. I think the heart of what I want to get to with the Lakers is, I have no idea who their best five players are.
Very fair, and that brings us to something that I wanted to talk to you about, which is their starting five. And I don't think their starting five will. I think their starting five will rarely resemble their closing five. And I know that the story has reported. The story reported one of the bigger revelations was Anthony Davis, his willingness to play the five. He spoke about that at Media Day.
He was so at Media Day, Anthony Davis was like, nothing is set in stone, which is not exactly, I think. I thought he was going to offer a little bit more of a strong encouragement for him.
He'll just never be excited about it. He'll never be excited about it.
I mean, Vogel said that it's going to be a 50-50 split. That remains to be seen to me. I don't know how you can start him at center and see how well that goes. And then another night, you know, and be like, you know what we need? DeAndre Jordan, who wasn't even the Nets rotation at the end of the playoffs. Rajon Rondo, by the way, another guy they brought back, wasn't in the rotation for the Clippers the end of their last two series. Dwight Howard, who they brought back, was getting killed every time he was on the floor against the Hawks. Anyway, go ahead. I derailed the starting lineup conversation, but you were about to mention who the Athletic reported.
Well, they report that, quote, a likely starting five will be AD at the five, Westbrook, LeBron James, Trevor Ariza, and Wayne Ellington. Frank Vogel has said that nothing is solidified there, and I believe that personally because they're not even in training camp yet, and why would they? With so many pieces, like Malik Monk could just like tear through everything in training camp and then he might be a starter. Who knows? But I just thought that Wayne Ellington being in this piece was like, is bizarre too harsh? Maybe.
I don't think bizarre is too harsh at all.
I was not expecting to see his name be inked into the projected starting five. Him being even in the rotation, frankly, I can see him dropping out of the rotation very quickly. No disrespect to him and his skill set, which is very important in the NBA. But he just makes more sense to me, like coming off the bench where he can go up against opposing second units that aren't going to try to focus in on him and aren't going to have as many weapons, who really expose his defensive liabilities, and he can space the floor and run off screens for LeBron or Westbrook. And assuming that the Lakers will have lineups that only have one of those guys to start second quarters and fourth quarters. So that seems like his role, right? Like, I just don't understand why he would start unless you were that starred for outside shooting. But as I texted you, we were texting about this because I was like kind of flabbergasted. I would just start Bazemore, I think. Just start like Kent Bazemore, who's an up and down 3-point shooter, but just has more size and a little bit more defensive versatility. Him, Ariza, and then their big three, I think, should be the starting five. What do you think?
I don't hate it, and I know what you're saying. Like, at this point, we're nitpicking. You know, it's like talking about like players 150 to 200 on the top 100. You know what I mean? Where it's like, do we want Bazemore or Ellington here? Does it really matter? Mm-hmm. I mean, Bazemore has never been like a volume shooter, and at the end of the day, I don't think his shot has as much gravity as Ellington, which might ultimately be more important for whatever they're trying to do. What freaks me out about the Lakers is who are their two-way role players? Who are the guys that you can trust on a floor in a playoff series? Ariza?
LeBron.
I mean, outside of LeBron the role players, it's Ariza and who else?
I mean, that's on a really good day, Kendrick Nunn, I think.
Yeah.
Talen Horton Tucker could make a jump here, and he is mentioned as a possibility as a starter, right.
They'd need his shooting to improve so much. So let's talk about it. Who do you think their closing five would be? I would not be surprised if their closing five is not currently on the roster.
Oh, that's, yeah. I mean, that should be 100% noted here. It happens every year. They're going to be big suitors in like buyout season, of course. They're the Lakers. They're, you know, teams that buy out veterans. you know, they're going to be a title contender and everybody wants to go play with LeBron and AD and live in Southern California. So, you know, I don't know who that is right now. This might be like a wonderful, if we didn't have another question to get to, this would be a wonderful time to transition into an email that we're about to talk about. But no, I don't know. Cause I mean, they don't have like a ton of tradable assets, so I don't see them being too active at the deadline, and the contracts that they have are usually are like vet min guys.
Right.
So I don't know. It's a really good question.
And it should have been Caruso had they kept him. But I mean, as that piece mentions, they let him walk purely for financial reasons, which remains insane to me.
Yeah. Let's transition right there where, the piece talks about Russell Westbrook, obviously, and his steadfast obsession with going to LA and not being left in Washington, D.C. It also talks about DeMar DeRozan as someone who LeBron was interested in, and they tried to put together a sign and trade that would have got DeMar DeRozan there, but they couldn't figure something out with the Spurs. And then there's obviously Buddy Hield, who apparently the Kings were very upset when LA backtracked there, which they should have been. I would have been very upset.
The
as
Lakers
well.
Should have been very upset when the Lakers backtracked there.
Yes, and maybe they will. But my question to you is just who do you think the Lakers would have been better off with coming out of this offseason among those three players? And when I ask that, we should try to factor in what the Lakers actually had to give up to get a Westbrook, or to, you know, they would have to give up less, presumably, to get DeRozan. We know they would have had to give up less to get Buddy Hield. So just who do you think is the best fit there, all things considered?
So that Buddy Hield deal would have been Montrez and KCP,
Kuzma.
Correct?
Kuzma. No,
Kuzma. And they would have kept KCP.
Correct.
Listen, if you could throw out a lineup that had Hield, KCP, LeBron, Anthony Davis, and then you have another avenue to find your starting point
guard. Or just Ariza, right?
Yeah, or just Ariza, yeah. I mean, but then I guess LeBron's playing point all year long. Which he kind of does anyway. I think it's no secret that we all thought the Hield deal was the obvious one and the one they should have done. I mean, it would have been a much better use of their assets than you still have, like you said, KCP, if you want to use him in another trade, or keep him because he was someone who is a very important part of your 2020 title team and someone who's proven that he can play late in playoff games. Hield obviously would have been by far the best shooter on the team. The Lakers are going to be a fascinating experiment in what is more important, having a roster that makes sense or having talent. Because they're making a huge bet on LeBron doing all his LeBron things to somehow make Russell Westbrook effective, to give the role player boost he usually gives to guys like Nunn, Ariza, Melo, whoever it is. This is such a huge bet on LeBron and AD to an extent, although not quite as big of an extent, but AD's going to have to do all the heavy lifting defensively on this team.
Oh, I think it's a huge bet on AD.
Yeah.
They need him to be like an MVP this season.
Yeah. It is just such a huge swing to take to basically say, we're going to get you all these guys. They don't really make sense, but we're just trusting you to be so talented that you're going to figure it out. And the crazy part is, Mike, that I would not be shocked at all if they won the finals. And that's just because of how much respect I have for LeBron and AD. And I think there's only one team that can really be considered a runaway favorite right now, and that's the Nets, but they have their own crazy situation. You know, what if the Nets make the finals and that week LA County is like, we're putting in an ordinance that you have to be vaccinated to play in arenas. What happens then?
First of all, I mean, that why isn't that ordinance?
Yeah, why isn't that ordinance?
Right,
great point. So I just think that it's such a weird gamble to take this late in LeBron's career when you should really just be getting every 3-and-D guy you possibly could get around him and AD. That's all that matters.
Yeah, I mean, I get the idea of taking releasing some of the strain offensively, the playmaking responsibilities, putting them on someone like Westbrook's shoulders. I also think that Westbrook is not a spring chicken. And 2 years ago was, you know, when he was in Houston, he didn't play in any back-to-backs because they were worried about his body. So I'm just, he did play in back-to-backs last year in Washington for sure, and has dealt with several key injuries over the past couple seasons. One of them was kind of COVID related, him coming back from COVID, and he strained his quad, I believe it was, and just wasn't his, didn't look like himself in the playoffs. But yeah, I it's going to be really interesting with the Lakers. I can't wait to just see how it all fits, as we've talked about on the floor. That's like, that's one of the biggest questions of the season. One of the most important questions in the entire NBA is how this is all going to fit together.
They really have such a huge opportunity to make us look stupid because I think we're so skeptical. But here's one last question I have about the Lakers, because, you know, their fans are really excited. You know, a lot of them think they're going to run through this league during the regular season. I just want to know, last 5 minutes of a playoff game, LeBron's going to have the ball in his hands. What is Russell Westbrook going to be doing?
I am not smart enough to answer that question. Only Russell Westbrook can answer that question.
And poor Frank Vogel has very little time on his contract to figure it out.
Okay. So that was a wonderful little Lakers primer there. We're obviously very negative, and at the same time, neither of us would be shocked if they won the NBA championship, which is why I labeled them the most polarizing team in the NBA.
They're just the weirdest team ever. The collection of personalities, Rondo and Westbrook on the same team, the collection of personalities, the talent, the stakes, it's going to be fascinating, and we'll definitely obviously be checking in on them several times throughout the year. But I just basically wanted to make sure we had an opportunity to lay out our skepticism and why before the season started, because I don't want to turn this into a Lakers pod just because I'm in LA, but I wanted to make sure we got that out there because it's going to be so weird. It's going to be so weird.
Okay, so now I want to read this email from this non-Lakers email from a longtime listener, Stavros, who writes in, "We can safely assume that Thaddeus Young will start but not end the 21-22 NBA season as a San Antonio Spur. Given his talent level, Young has the potential to significantly improve the championship chances of several contenders. So which franchise would benefit most from attaining him?" Thank you so much, Stavros. That is a wonderful question. I'm just going to – I'll kick things off here, Ro, if that's all right with you. I know that this question is supposed to be about contenders, and Thad Young has been somewhat linked to the Phoenix Suns as a possible fit at one point. But I personally see Thad Young as someone who just better fits on teams that are either trying to progress from bad to respectable or respectable to good, not necessarily like good to great, if that makes any sense. So like put him on the Timberwolves as their starting power forward, and he's just a humongous addition. Put him on the Cleveland Cavaliers as their starting power forward, and he's a humongous addition. Put him on the Raptors. Put him on the Grizzlies as their starting centers, and just like, let's go. I'm so here for that. So when you talk about contenders, I don't know if he can start for any of them because of his shooting and just the positional restrictions that he has. And that was one of the reasons why he couldn't even start for major stretches last season in Chicago. But like, I think he would be absolutely perfect as Utah's backup center. Like, I don't think that that's realistic for a variety of reasons. Maybe it is. Maybe they're able to kind of.
You want to break up the Whiteside Gobert duo?
I mean, it's more like they better be able to play with Rudy Gay as their backup five in the playoffs, or they're in trouble, is how I view it. So, like Thad Young for defensive purposes and playmaking purposes would just be such an upgrade, I think, over Rudy Gay, who I think, you know, makes enough sense.
Rudy Gay was a great pickup for them, but he can play five in the playoffs, I think, for a bit, but it's a little bit of a dice roll.
Here's the deal. Like, he would have been great in that Clippers series.
Yes, yes.
But there are other matchups where he might not be. Like if, for example, you go up against the Suns and they have a healthy Saric or someone like that as their backup five, like Saric is just going to go into the post and then do work. So I think it's a matchup dependent thing and they could get into trouble. So Thad Young would have been would be tremendous there. I don't think it's possible or anything's possible, but I don't think it's likely that he ends up there. But that would be the team that I really would love to see him play on.
Listen, I'm taking the low hanging fruit here and I'm saying bienvenidos, Thad Young. Let's get him down in Miami. Let's get him in the best shape of his life. Let's introduce him to some culture. Some coladas, you know, and just let him cook, baby, on in downtown Miami. Now, here's what I'd say about why I actually like Thad Young to Miami. And I also just want to say to Stavros, I love the email. I'm not confident that Thad Young doesn't finish the year on the Spurs because I don't know what the Spurs are doing ever. None of their moves make sense. I don't know. They're not really rebuilding fully yet. I don't know. The Spurs are just weird.
You don't think they're rebuilding?
I think they finally are, but I feel like they also weirdly try to remain somewhat competitive for Pop. If anyone would not want Young to go to a contender just purely out of spite, it strikes me as Greg Popovich. So, like, they didn't trade Rudy Gay last year. A lot of people thought they would. So, you know, I'm just saying I'm not fully confident that he's not going to end up on the Spurs for the whole year. But here's what I'd say about the Heat. And why I like Thad Young there, even though he's not exactly a spring chicken, to use your term, anymore either. Their power rotation right now, outside of Bam Adebayo, is P.J. Tucker, Markieff Morris, and Dwayne Dedmon. Now, shout out to Dwayne Dedmon. He was the team's MVP last year. Everyone in Miami
He played great.
Everyone in Miami loves Dedmon. But like you mentioned, there's just going to be some matchups in the playoffs that make less sense for him to come in as the backup five. They have Markieff and P.J. Tucker. By the end of the playoffs, P.J. Tucker was not doing much offensively. And then you look at their minutes averages for the last few years between Markieff and P.J., it doesn't add up to 48, okay? One of those guys is going to have to stretch himself more than he has in the past. And with both of them being vets, I think, you know, health and depth are going to be two fascinating issues for the Heat next year. If they could get someone like Thad Young, I think they do need help depth wise, and I think that he'd actually get a big chance to play there in the playoffs. At this point, I think they're going to lean into just being a team that wants to, you know, live in the mud and not really try to score the basketball. So I think he would fit in with kind of the makeup of this roster. But that's one I genuinely think is a good fit for both sides because he'd get an opportunity to play. And that team, I think, needs all the depth it can get.
Yeah, you hit it. You hit the nail on the head there when you said that they would be playing in the mud with Thad Young. I don't think he can play at the same time as Bam Adebayo. You'd have a little bit of difficulty playing him, even with Jimmy Butler.
Sure, but you know, there's those matchups where the other team's backup five isn't a big, and you don't want to play Dedmon. I think that they need someone like Young.
Just go zone, baby. Play Tyler Hero at the five. Go, let's go crazy.
Positionless, baby. There's no positions anymore. That's what Eric Spoelstra likes to say.
Okay, so we are going to now transition into a topic that has been in our outline, just collecting dust, basically for the entire offseason.
And it's something we want to get to. It's something we want to get to, yeah.
I think this is a perfect time to dust it off. I'm just going to call it the sustainability topic. Sustainability, that's an absolutely atrocious thing that I just said. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But what we are about to discuss is all the weird stuff that happened last year. How much of it is for real heading into this upcoming season? Because I think as we distance ourselves from last year and just its utter strangeness, we kind of forget how unique and singular last year really was to all the players for a variety of reasons.
I think last year was more weird than the bubble year. Let me put it that way.
Agree. I totally agree. And so with health and safety protocol, I mean, there will be a little bit of that this year, potentially, just given the unvaccinated players. But there are just, you know, over 90% of the league is vaccinated, we should see, you know, the lost time go down for soon. That is a hope that we'll see. And also the schedule will be normalized. It won't be as truncated, et cetera. So a few things will normalize, and a few stats that we saw last year will not be maintained, I would think. So we're gonna touch on a few of these. I asked you, Rohan, to bring three things to the table that happened last season that were unexpected enough to have their sustainability questioned. Do you want to throw me one of those that I don't even know what you've thought of? You have not shared them with me beforehand, or do you want to get cracking on a few of the ones that I have listed here?
I can throw you one of mine.
Okay, let's go.
You mentioned another player who I think really showed out in this category. I think this player is better at this particular skill, but his team just took a huge bet on him. And that's Michael mm-hmm. Porter Jr., who shot 45% from three last year. And it's funny. I've always thought MPJ had the talent to be a really good scorer, but he's a scorer, not a shooter, if that makes sense. I still don't look at his jump shot form and it looks particularly pure. I just was a little bit surprised at how well he maintained his three-point shooting all year long. And he was letting it fly. I mean, he's a high-volume guy. He's getting them up, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times a game. So he's not shy from letting it fly out there. The Nuggets obviously just gave MPJ the max extension. He's not vaccinated, so who knows what issues could arise from that this season. It's a pretty big bet to take on someone who, frankly, is doing something that makes his team in a less advantageous position. So that's a big bet on MPJ, who's mercurial. We've traded him like 15 times on this podcast since the playoffs. But that's what I'm looking at where – okay, if he's really shooting like that and Murray does come back healthy and they do have Gordon for a full year now, they can be super, super dangerous. But I don't know. Maybe you feel confident, but I've always looked at him as more of a scorer than a shooter. And I think that is an important distinction.
I think he's both, frankly. Like, his catch and shoot numbers are terrific. He makes tough outside shots as well. I'm not going to say I was surprised at all by the extension news, because he's got that talent, and if he were to hit restricted free agency, someone's going to offer them the max, so you mm-hmm. might as well just hit him with the extension, especially this upcoming offseason where there's just no free agents that are attractive. So you might as well just hit him now, and the last year of the deal, I believe, is not fully guaranteed.
Yeah, only about $12 million are guaranteed.
So that's great to kind of protect yourself if you're the organization from, he's had multiple serious injuries over the past few years, back surgery, et cetera. So, you know, I wasn't surprised, but it was just, on the heels of Aaron Gordon, I thought they were going to almost have to pick either or, just given.
I thought so too.
Given the incredible price tags that are coming for sure with the price tag, I should say, that's coming for Jokic, who is eligible next summer for a Supermax extension. Like, it's just going to get real pricey.
Maybe they picked MPJ and Gordon over Jokic.
Maybe. Yeah. I think you might be onto something.
Here's what I'll say, and I brought this up when our good friend Paolo Ughetti was on the show. Shout out to the Nuggets, though, because we get on teams all the time for not ponying up to pay their guys. And this is a small market team that's now drafted and signed three guys to max extensions. They did what the Oklahoma City Thunder were not willing to do. And on top of that, handed out an extension to a guy like Aaron Gordon, who they traded for. Whether or not they all end up being smash hits or they ended up winning a championship, this is what all teams should be encouraged to do. So shout out to the Nuggets for at least putting their money where their mouth is.
Absolutely. So I guess so. You're falling on that Michael Porter Jr. Let's see. The numbers are last season.
Hey, Mike, I'm just asking questions, okay?
Well, I'm putting you. Hey, I get criticized for being.
I did some of my own research, and yeah, and I'm just asking questions. Yeah.
So last season, Michael Porter Jr. took 6.3.
Was it 44.6%? What was he at?
44.5. You could not have been more wrong. So do you think he's that is unsustainable for him? The previous season, he shot 42.2 on a slightly lower, or I guess half of the volume in terms of threes per game. But that's also very accurate. So do you think that that's dropping down, or what are you thinking, especially with Jamal Murray? Not exactly.
Well, that's really the big one, right? Is Murray's going to be out for probably most of the regular season, if not all of it. Mm-hmm. I have to imagine it's going to come down a little bit, right? I mean, 45, even if he's a great shooter, that's an insane percentage. And theoretically, there's going to be a lot more attention on him now with Murray. I think it comes down a little bit. The question is how much, because if it's around like, if it's at like 42, okay, that's not a big deal. That's sustainable. If it's at like 37 or 38, I'm just curious to see how that changes things.
So I'm just looking this up real quick. When Jamal Murray was on the floor with Michael Porter Jr. last season, MPJ shot 45.2% from behind the three-point line on 4.1 attempts per game. When Jamal Murray was off the floor, Michael Porter Jr. shot 44.1% on 3.8 attempts per game. So
MPJ.
I think he's really good, and this is a potential third-year leap season for him. I'm always high on
love the third-year leap. Yeah,
I love it. I love it. I love it.
We got to get third-year leap T-shirts.
That's a great idea.
Yeah,
that might be your best idea, honestly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll talk about that after we record today's show. Hopefully, we get through it in one piece. Okay, so let's move on from MPJ. I'm going to throw you one of the items that I have listed here. And it's the steep trajectory of offensive efficiency. So last season gave us 8 of the 10 most efficient offenses in NBA history, including the top 7 most efficient offenses in NBA history. And my question is simple, like, will that trend continue? What do you think?
I do think the game's obviously, it's all offense now. I don't think you can say defense is just not as important as it was even 5 years ago. I do think that one's taken a step back. I think we saw in the playoffs, teams like the Suns and Bucks had good defenses and that mattered. I think having crowds in arenas is going to help defenses a lot. I think having crowds in arenas is going to make it a little tougher for offenses to just shoot as well as they did.
Good
I think
point.
Defensive effort will be better in a more normal season that's not as truncated and guys coming in and out, et cetera. I think that the game is still always going to be trending towards better offenses. I don't see that trend slowing down. I don't see it being as jarring as it was last year.
I think that this rule change that's trying to take out, I think they're basically, it's not a rule change, it's a reinterpretation of the rules, to be technical, but this elimination of quote abrupt unnatural movements from ball handlers. So, you know, Steph Curry pump faking a defender into the air and then jumping into the defender, for example. That's something that they're just not going to have. They're not going to reward the offensive player with stuff like that. And you get a lot of really efficient offense out of possessions like that. And Luka does it. Trey does it. Steph does. There's a ton of Harden, et cetera. So
Harden? No way. I'm kidding.
So I think that could potentially bring it down a little bit. That said, real quick stat for you. In 2016, 28.5% of all shots were threes. Last year, 39.2% of all shots were threes. And it just keeps going up and up and up and up and up every year. So the three-point line is just changing basketball. I'm not saying we're going to see this season's going to yield, again, the 7 most efficient offenses in NBA history. I agree with you that crowds and the schedule and a lot of those things were a factor there. But the NBA is defined by offense, I think, at least in the regular season. Okay, so do you want to
I kind of answered that question and you kind of didn't, but that's okay.
I agreed with you.
Okay.
We're on the same page.
Okay,
Rohan, why don't you give me your next item for us to discuss here?
Okay, Mike, do you want my curveball special one that's going to make you mad?
Yes.
Or
yes.
do you want
No. I don't even want to know what your next thing was. Just give me the curveball.
I can't. Now I'm okay. I shouldn't have even given you the option. I should have saved my curveball.
What was the other option? Because I know our listeners are going to be upset if I don't ask.
Okay, the other option was less exciting anyway. But I saw that you put the Suns' good health. Sorry to spoil one of yours, but I put the Lakers' bad health in mine. Because, and I think that's a more interesting
they have a
conversation.
Completely different team.
but the real question is LeBron and AD, right? Because right. Now we've seen two LeBron seasons in LA cut short by injury. He is turning 37 this year. Then we have AD, who people like to say is injury prone. I don't necessarily believe that, but just again, this is not going to be an easy season. They've had a longer offseason now, but still not quite a full one. So I just think those two are interesting. It's worth keeping an eye on. But here's one that really betrays the spirit of this conversation, because I'm looking at a one-game sample size.
Okay.
Can you guess what it is?
No, I cannot.
This is, I think, the most important thing in the NBA, this one game. And it's Giannis Antetokounmpo shooting 17 of 19 from the free throw line in game six of the NBA Finals.
Okay.
Because if that is sustainable, he's going to average 40 points a night. He won't be stopped. He will just go nuts from the free throw line, and there will be no defending him, because you can try to play the jump shot, but he'll drive into the lane and you will foul him because it's your best bet. You don't want to get dunked on. But in all seriousness, I mean, that's a big one. He stepped up the line so confidently that night. The Suns, I wonder if they're still kicking themselves to this day, because that was a close game. That was a 7-point game and was very close in the fourth quarter. And if Giannis has a normal free throw shooting night, the Suns maybe win. Yeah, I just think Giannis's free throw shooting, if he found something in that game, which I know sounds absurd, I get it, but that's what free throw shooting can be like sometimes. That's a truly a game changer.
Yeah, so Giannis shot 58.7% from the free throw line in the playoffs last year. He was at 58% the year before. In the regular season, he was at 68.5 last year, 63.3 the year before, 73, 76, 77 in the previous seasons, three seasons. So it's possible he gets up to a pretty good number that you can live with for sure. 89%, which is, I believe, what his percentage was.
I mean,
what
if he got to 81?
That's really good free throw shooting. And I don't know. I'm a big believer in just get up there and shoot. And
agreed.
He's literally the exact opposite.
That is true. That is
just
true.
Get up there and shoot the ball. Like, that's when I played basketball, there's no time to think.
You just gave me a true like war flashback to Suns fans counting to 10 and how I can never hear someone count to 10 again in my entire life.
So Chris Middleton, who's an excellent free throw shooter, shot 89.8% from the free throw line last season. I'm looking at the team's numbers right now. Drew Holiday, a pretty good shooter, 78%. I mean, 81% is just going to be like, that would be a humongous.
81 won't happen, but I mean, you mentioned 77, 76 in the past. If he can get up to 79, 80, he's just such a much more aggressive force now than he was even 2 years ago. I just think it's, especially in the playoffs. In the playoffs, if he's shooting like that, because we see teams time and time again send him to the line, and the playoffs he typically shoots worse, it would just be massive, massive game changer.
So we both agree that he is not doing that. Okay, great. Let's move on.
I think he might shoot well. I'm not going there with you. I think he might shoot well from the free throw line this year in the playoffs.
I think he can shoot around what his career average is, which is, 72, 73 maybe.
Okay.
That's good. That's his career average. So, get up there, you're fine. It's no big deal. He's not shooting 82%. That's just not going to happen. Okay, I have a fun one. I'm not going to say a fun one. They're all fun, so I don't want to single this out.
I would disagree and say none of Mike's are fun, but continue.
Wow, damn. Okay, so the Clippers made 44.4% of their wide open threes last season, which is the most accurate mark since we've been able to track that sort of thing. They also led the league in three-point shooting overall at 41.1%. Only three teams in NBA history have ever been more accurate. So my question is the Clippers shooting for real, Rohan?
I'm glad you brought this question up only because the Clippers were really, really good last year. And their shooting was obviously a big reason why. And I think a lot of people wondered, can they keep it up in the playoffs? And they did. They were shooting really well in the playoffs. Obviously, we know what they did against the Jazz when they went small, but even against the Mavericks, really good shooting team. I mean, I think the obvious answer this year is no, just because they don't have Kawhi and it's going to be a little bit different. I don't know if Reggie Jackson is going to shoot as well as he did. How many minutes are they going to play Justice Winslow? He's not quite a shooter. So I think it goes down just because Kawhi's out, but I still have a lot of Clippers optimism this year. I think they're going to be really good. I would say I don't think that they're a title team without Kawhi, but I think Paul George is probably the most confident he's ever been in his career, and they still have a really good team. Also, they get a healthy year from Ibaka. Obviously, he's getting a little long in the tooth now. He's a vet, but I think even when he played last year, I don't know if he was fully there every night. So I think the Clippers are going to be really good, but it would be crazy if, as a team, they shot as well as they did last year.
I agree. And the number one reason, besides just like the outrageous hot shooting from guys like, you know, someone like Marcus Morris, who was just didn't miss. Reggie Jackson was way up there. I don't see those guys carrying it over. Yeah. But most importantly, you
the
nailed it
gyms.
With, yeah, true, with, yeah. with sure. You yeah. nailed it with Kawhi.
Yeah.
I was looking up some numbers on cleaning the glass to prepare for this, and among all players who played at least 1,000 minutes last season, Kawhi was number one in terms of how his team shot non-corner threes and just all general threes. They were 8% more accurate. The Clippers were 8% more accurate with Kawhi on the floor, which was number one among all players who logged at least 1,000 minutes, and 6% on regular threes, which was also number one. So obviously
MPJ would shoot like 52% from three if he was playing next to Kawhi, basically.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there's really no other way to shoot. I mean, Kawhi is a superstar. He's a playmaker. He draws so much attention. So
the Clippers last year at times, I think, really resembled the team we thought they were going to be when they signed Kawhi and Paul George, which was offensively. Yeah, the shooting, the space was just so good. It was really a beautifully built team for the modern NBA. And they generated the looks you thought they would generate, and they hit. They hit again and again and again. And Batum was a great addition. But, yeah, I think we're on the same page. Without Kawhi, there's no way they can do that again.
Let's talk about Julius Randle, who's kind of like the elephant in the room here.
Julius Randle is like the poster child of this conversation.
He literally is. This is his season last year is kind of what
an all-time
sparked
this outlier
idea.
Season.
It sparked like, this entire conversation. Frankly.
He had the kind of season that this is going to sound dumb, but I'm being serious. It's like he had the kind of season you only see in Major League Baseball, where it's like all of a sudden it's like, wait, this guy's hitting 60 home runs, or this guy. And like, I know in the past it's been like associated with steroids, and I want to be clear that that's not at all what I'm insinuating.
We are not making that insinuation.
Not
at
the slightest. But that kind of random season doesn't really happen in basketball. It happens. It's like Nick Foles throwing for 40 touchdowns under Chip Kelly or whatever that was. Like we see it in other sports sometimes, but you
can
never.
Can I just cut you off? Can I cut you off right there? Can you? No, there's no more NFL. Like analogies.
That was such a good analogy. Just because Nick Foles whipped up on the Patriots. Just because Nick Foles whipped up on your evil Patriots. You know, just because Brady and Belichick were too busy staring at the red hats in their locker room as opposed to getting ready for the Super Bowl. Don't be mad at my really apt Nick Foles comparison, because we see these types of random seasons in other sports, but we don't really see them in basketball.
Okay, so on his way to making an All-NBA team and earning a $100 million extension, Julius Randle made 40% of his pull-up threes last year and 41.7% of his spot-up threes last year. Both are just like way, way, way above his career average marks. I do not think that this is for real.
I mean, Paul George, when he was like top three in MVP, was shooting like that from, you know what I mean? Like, it's really crazy. Like, even the best shooters don't usually shoot that well.
Right. And it was on a pretty decent volume. And yeah, these were tough.
Like seven even, threes you, a game or something. Yeah.
If you watch the Knicks, like, some of these shots were like actually contested too. It's just like he's taking bailout
shots like all the time for that offense.
Right. And I don't want to say he's bad. I would be surprised, and I'm not saying he didn't deserve the extension. I would be surprised if he was I think I would be surprised if he was an all-star again. I'm just going to say that honestly, in all seriousness. And I will be very surprised if he ever makes another All-NBA team. Hopefully he does for his sake, and I'm not rooting against him or anything like that. I'm very skeptical about the year that he just had.
Here's what it comes down to with Julius Randle, who I've always been a fan of. I loved him on the Lakers. I've always thought he was a fun player. I want guys like him in the league to succeed. I want there to be a room for bigs like him. There is no like rational way to believe that he's going to put up those same numbers again. That doesn't mean he falls off entirely and he might be a fringe all-star or close to being an all-star, but the issue with the Knicks is that the difference between the Randle of last year versus a Randle who is good but not an all-star, it changes them dramatically because that's how good he was last year. That's how much he bailed him out on offense last year. So, and that's why I think we've been skeptical about them this whole summer, but it would be great if Randle did again. It would just be defying all expectations, defying all history, defying all odds for him to maintain the pace that he had last year, which really came out of nowhere, because the book on him was he could be an effective player, but never this guy's a great shooter. This guy's a knockdown 3-point guy. Like, pull up 3-point guy. Yeah. Like, that's Julius Randle. Like, that was never, ever, ever his game. So it would just be a complete transformation that is, we're not saying it's impossible, just that you don't really ever see it. And based on that precedent alone, you have to say it's not going to happen again, but hey, he can make us look like huge idiots. And that would be cool, 'cause we like Julius Randle.
Sure. Do you have any others, any other topics that you're bringing to the table here, Rohan?
I do think it's worth pointing out just one more time the Lakers injury thing, because their top two guys obviously both missed significant time last year and were hurt during the first round. And, you know, LeBron felt like he was on his way to an MVP year until he stepped on Solomon Hill's foot and got the high ankle sprain. And some people will say, well, that's a freak injury and he wouldn't have gotten hurt if Solomon Hill didn't have his foot there. Other people might say that in the past, LeBron wouldn't have actually sprained his ankle. He wouldn't be able to walk that one off. I just think that their durability is something definitely worth keeping an eye on this season and moving forward, because like I said, there's one age on the Lakers that matters, and it's LeBron, and he's going to be 37 in December. I was having a conversation with a friend the other day thinking about when would LeBron retire? Because right now he's still consensus top three player in the NBA. He could easily win finals MVP again. No one would be surprised. Mm-hmm. Is he just going to have an injury one day and it's done? Is he just going to come in one year like this year where it's a normal season and all of a sudden he doesn't have it anymore? We've no idea. He, like Julius Randle, is breaking all conception, perception, reality we have about what the end of someone's career is supposed to look like, that it's impossible to figure out when he's going to slow down. But it's just you have to at least wonder it going into every season because of how many miles he has on his body, and now with the injuries as well.
Yeah, I think obviously there's going to be continued decline from this point on physically for him. What's fascinating about LeBron, of course, is that he's also the smartest player maybe ever. And I said this on the pod that I did with Jeremy Wu last week, but when I was writing my blurb for LeBron for the top 100, it's just like I couldn't not consider just his brain and his ability to slow the game down in a way that, you know, we always talk about, great players and their ability to just turn the game into molasses. It's such a fast game, basketball, but LeBron does that better than anyone maybe ever on both ends. He just sees the future.
I believe the phrase you used is sees the future, and that's the best way to describe LeBron, because he knows what your team is going to do before they do it. And that's what makes him so great, is he does that thing that's one step ahead. And it's, yeah, I just think that how he holds up these next few years, like, is he going to be a top three player until he's 40? That's nuts. Like, this is just nuts. So we've never seen.
I'm a little skeptical of that personally. That's a long time from now.
Yeah.
But he's great. He's awesome. He's maybe the best player of all time and the best player of his generation easily. So, I think this is like a really good place to wrap up the entire episode.
Ending.
No, but I want to, we have one more email that I actually wanted to read.
Okay.
So, let's go to that. You know, I like circuitous endings, if that isn't even the right word, where we started with the Lakers, we could have ended with the Lakers there, but this email was just too good.
Can I just say something real quick before you get in? I would love to know, because I'm sure there are, I just want to hear from the Open Floor Globe what things they think are sustainable or unsustainable, because that to me is the most fascinating subplot of last season that we've hinted at and we've written a little bit about at Sports Illustrated, but to me is such a the ramifications of betting on something that's not real in the NBA can be so huge. I mean, we mentioned the Knicks giving Julius Randle an extension, one that we both think he deserves. It's just going to be really fascinating to see how teams respond to the last couple years of NBA basketball, which is why that sustainability conversation is so important, because it determines how these teams feel about their futures, et cetera. I think it's going to be really interesting to see just kind of the effects of the last couple years, how they play out in the NBA.
Yeah, like some of the other topics that we're just not going to go too in-depth on because of time is like the Hawks as a team getting to the conference finals and being 27 and 11 under Nate McMillan in the regular season. Just like, is that for real? And then more specifically, we had Joel Embiid's mid-range field goal percentage, just how he shot from on long twos last year. It was 48%, and the previous year it was 38%.
Can I just tell you, that's the one I feel good about. Is Embiid's mid-range shooting.
That's the one that I think continues. As high?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he's always had great touch and always been a good shooter. And I think that, I don't think it'll be 48 every year, but I think it'll be like 44 to 48 every year.
Okay. So let's get to this email from Derek, who writes, "Hey guys, enjoyed the Will Smith references the last time. The film you were thinking of is Gemini Man, and it is truly awful. Hitch is one of the best rom-coms of the 21st century. Take care, stay safe, love basketball." Derek, I just wanted to read that email because even though there were no questions, and for anyone who did not listen to our episode last week, they're probably wondering what the hell's going on. But we wanted to shout you out for just obviously being a wonderful listener.
Thank you very much. It was funny. I remembered the name Gemini Man right after our podcast ended and almost texted you, but I didn't want you to think I was some kind of like Will Smith sicko. Directed by Ang Lee, who's a great director, but that movie just looked terrible from the trailers. Like, it looked awful. So Will Smith obviously had that big profile in GQ. It was great, written by Wesley Lowery. Highly recommend checking it out. But yeah, man, Will Smith's just got a lot of disappointments for someone who I think pound for pound could be one of our most talented people on the planet. And he's just got a lot of stinkers up in the filmography on Wikipedia, Gemini Man high up there. So, and then you look at Hitch. Hitch is such a great, lovable movie. He could have done one of those a year and we would have been like, thank you, Will. We would have been just loving him. But I don't know. He claims he's in his bleep it 50s now, but hopefully that means he makes some good movies.
I got to read that profile. Really looking forward to that. Always have loved Will Smith. Fresh Prince and DJ Jazzy Jeff's Greatest Hits is one of the 10 greatest albums ever made. Just going to throw that out there. So
and I got killed for my Hitch is the best Will Smith movie take, and you just dropped that bomb
that
on us.
That album is no skips. Shout out to Shea Serrano. Absolutely tremendous from front to back. Okay, so that's going to do it for today's show. Again, please email us in all of your, you know, sustainability questions, as Rohan said earlier. That would be wonderful. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. And any other question that you guys have about the NBA season, which is really right around the corner. There's a preseason game, I think, this Sunday between the Nets and the Lakers. Yeah, I think that's this Sunday. Goodness. It might be next Sunday. I'd have to double check. And
let me tell you something. Preseason is, I regard, maybe 1 degree higher than summer league, in that I don't regard it at all.
I'll have to watch. I'm not gonna lie. Preseason's a little more serious, but I get where you're coming from. Okay, so thank you again to all of our listeners. Everybody, please stay safe. Everybody, please continue to enjoy what is left of the NBA offseason.